So yeah, so this Sunday, downtown, we're going to be kicking off new sermon series, None Like Him, looking at the attributes of God, taking several weeks to just meditate and reflect on who God is, and especially those that at first glance kind of might seem at odds with one another. So things like, you know, God's incomprehensibility, like we can't fully understand him, but also his knowability, that he allows us to know him. Things like his sovereignty and his goodness. Things like his self-sufficiency, but also his jealousy. His holiness and his mercy. His eternality and his immanence. Like all of those things and how the fullness of the invisible God is clearly seen in the excellencies of Christ. So we're going to be exploring all of that over several weeks. And our hope is really to leave us, to leave people, to leave our church with this sense of God's glory. That truly there's no one like him. And instead of spending time today kind of, you know, normally with the sermon series, a lot of time I get tapped in to kind of go over the what and try to kind of give you guys a bit of a primer for stuff. Instead of doing that, I really just want us today to look at the why. So look at the why. Why should we begin this new year with a series looking at attributes, right? Looking at the first few chapters of Grudem, if you will, you know, and you're like, okay, where are we going with this? And I believe this series actually is really timely for our church. The new year is kind of a cultural you are here moment, right? For a lot of us. I don't know about you, but I naturally gravitate towards introspection at this time of year. And the new year marks this opportunity to reflect on the past year and to make goals for the coming year, to look at where have I been, what's happened, and where do I want to go? And I don't know about you, but for me, a lot of times, all the blessings of the past year, all the things I feel grateful for, all the accomplishments I feel, also all the fears and failures and disappointments and longings that I feel, all of those things just start bubbling up naturally in my heart as kind of the new year crosses. And here's the thing, every resolution, every goal, every longing that we feel actually recognizes something I think profound, and that's the world is not the way it should be, right? And here's the thing, and we recognize we ourselves are the problem, right? We don't make resolutions for other people, right? I don't be like, I resolve that Chad is going to, you know, work out this year. Like, that doesn't work. I can only make resolutions for myself. He works out more than me, so. It's really true, though. He works out more than me. But here's the deal is that given space, like given cultural space to sit and reflect, it's kind of amazing that we all kind of sense this gap in our souls, right? This tragic gap. We sense this longing for something better. We sense longing for the good life. In our hearts, really, if you listen closely, it's like our hearts are crying out for God's blessing, for God's blessing to flow far as the curse is found. Our world is, in some ways, without even realizing it, kind of collectively groaning for more of God. And so heading into the new year, more than we need anything else, more than resolutions, more than white-knuckled effort, we need a bigger vision of God. We need to see God as he really is. And listen, God is a God who wants to be known. Like, let that sink in for a moment. God is a God who wants to be known. He's not a God off in heaven somewhere, just kind of blind and ignorant of what's going on in our world, really indifferent, who cares? He's not a God who kind of deceptively leaves these false trails or secret breadcrumbs, just seeing who's gonna be smart enough to figure him out. He doesn't put roadblocks in our way to keep us from knowing him. No, he is a God who draws near. He's a God who speaks. He's a God who bends low that we might actually see him face to face. And just consider the lengths God has gone to show us who he is. I mean, he's displayed his nature in the very fabric of creation. Like, we can look at the world and see him. He's placed eternity in our hearts, so we all even just feel this call towards him. And even that would be enough to show that God wants to be known. But he goes even further, and he gives us his word. And through different authors and genres and cultures and ages, God speaks. He uses poetry, but he also uses history. And he also uses law. He comes to us in a whirlwind, shaking the very foundations of the earth. And yet he also comes to us as a gentle whisper. Like, he at times condescends to us and speaks plainly. And in other times he pulls back the curtain. He draws us up to him and breaks our brain with his glory. Like, what more could you ask for? Like, what other way could God show he wants to be known? And then he goes even further, and as the final word, he draws near to us in Jesus, God in the flesh, a God we can see and hear and touch, right? John 1, no one has ever seen God. That's in some ways tragic, part of who God is, but it's like no one's ever seen God. But the only God who's at the Father's side, he has made him known. So we see God in Jesus. So for those of you who are keeping up with the church calendar, today is Epiphany. Christmas is finally over. You have my blessing to stop listening to Christmas music now and put away any decorations that you have up. But Epiphany is here. And Epiphany comes from this Greek word that means appearing or revealing. And it traditionally looks at how through the coming of the Magi and through the baptism of Jesus, God revealed himself to the world. And that's what we celebrate, that God has shown us who he is. God is a God who wants to be known. And if he had never revealed himself to us, we would just be left fumbling in the dark on our own, trying to figure out. We would build a God who looks a lot like us, a God of our own making, a God who never confronts you or tries to change you, a God who wants you to just follow your heart and do whatever feels right to you, a God who keeps his distance unless we need something from him. But if God is a God who wants to be known, and if God's a God who's revealed himself to us, then it doesn't really matter so much who we would like God to be. It doesn't really matter so much whether we think we could worship a God like that. Like, what matters is, who does this God say he is? And will we bow the knee to him? Like, God is who he is, and if we receive him, we have to receive him as he is. So we're going to be diving into this series on attributes, and what I want to do today is really just set up a couple prayers. Like, I want us to be prayerful heading into this series and pray for ourselves and pray for our people to keep these in front of us as we kind of go through this series. So just a few prayers and then I'll be done. So the first one, Lord, increase our affections for you. Lord, increase our affections for you. So in learning about God's attributes, we aren't merely wanting to beef up our theology and Bible trivia. I'm less concerned with you knowing what aseity means, though you really, really should know what that means. But what I want and what we want is for our affections to catch up with the beauty and glory of God, with the things we already even know about him, that our hearts and our affections and our desires would catch up to that. Because God doesn't want you solely to have a mental knowledge of him. He wants you to behold and treasure him, just like we were singing about. To delight in him. To find joy in his character. As the Catechism puts it, man's chief end, the very reason we were made, is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Right? These were stodgy old Puritans who were writing this. And we're like, we need to enjoy God. Enjoy him. Like, we can't ever lose that. We make it our aim to relish in God, to delight in him, to receive him. So Jonathan Edwards, he puts it so great when he says, God's glorified not only by his glory being seen, but by its being rejoiced in. Like, let's keep that in our minds and hearts. When those that see it delight in it, God is more glorified than if they only see it. He that testifies his idea of God's glory doesn't glorify God so much as he that testifies also his praise of it and his delight in it. Right? Here's another way of putting it as an analogy. It's good that I know things about my wife, right? I should learn her character and personality, what she likes and dislikes, her strengths and weaknesses. All of those things are really good. But our relationship isn't grounded by how many true things we know about each other. Or even if I have a right knowledge of her. It's grounded in our love and delight in one another. In other words, my wife's not praised by me memorizing facts about her. She's praised when I see her for who she really is and yet have great delight and joy in her. And that's the point. When we see God for who he really is, it's not just, okay, here's the truth. It's our hearts skip a beat and awaken in joy with God. When we look at his attributes, the worst thing we could do is learn more information about him and leave somehow unmoved by what we've seen. Like, we want to revel in what he's revealed because he is really that beautiful. He is really that glorious. He is really worthy of delight. And when we see him rightly, joy is going to rise up in our hearts. I mean, to me, this is what makes the gospel message so much shine so much brighter than philosophies like Buddhism, where like the Bible doesn't teach desires are bad. In fact, our affections are good. They're given by God. They're there for a reason. And our problem is not that we love, but that our loves are what Augustine said are disordered, right? So in City of God, here's how Augustine puts it. And thus beauty, which is indeed God's handiwork, what he made, but only a temporal, carnal, and lowly kind of good, is not fitly loved in preference to God, the eternal, spiritual, and unchangeable good. So he's saying beauty, God made beauty, it's a good thing, but compared to God, it's nothing, right? It's not fit to favor this over that. When the miser prefers his gold to justice, it's through no fault of the gold, but of the man. And so with every created thing, for though it be good, it may be loved with an evil as well as with a good love. It's loved rightly when it's loved ordinately or in order, in the right place. Evilly when inordinately. So that it seems to me that a brief but true definition of virtue is to say it is the order of love. So our desires are actually good. The problem is our disordered loves. Our problem is, as C.S. Lewis says, like, we're too often satisfied with the other things of this world instead of finding our ultimate satisfaction in God. We were made to treasure God, to enjoy him. There is none like him and none greater than him. And we shouldn't be afraid to feel joy and excitement and delight for God. In fact, our affection should match the glory of who he is. Like, and he's greater than anything else. And our affection should catch up to that. And that's really what worship is, right? We're delighting in who God is. One last thing on this. Piper, in Desiring God, says this about worship. He says, worship is a way of gladly reflecting back to God the radiance of his worth. It's not a mere act of willpower by which we perform outward works. Without the engagement of the heart, we do not really worship. The engagement of the heart in worship is the coming alive of the feelings and emotions and affections of the heart. Where feelings for God are dead, worship is dead. So part of this series, we want people's hearts and affections and emotions to be stirred, not just from like our own willpower or what's going on, but with the beauty of who God is. True worship, true affection, true delight in God. So, Lord, let us behold you. Let us find joy in you. Help us to see you as you are and increase our affections, God. And where our affections have died, where our affections have been minimized, where we've been taken in by other gods of this world, Lord, would you just shine the beauty of your glory and stir our hearts for you? So, first prayer, Lord, increase our affection. Secondly, Lord, transform us into your image. Transform us into your image. So Calvin, he recognized that our knowledge of God and the knowledge of ourself are linked together. They're connected. We cannot comprehend one without the other. So when we look inward and we try to truly understand ourselves, we find longings and desires that only the living God can satisfy. On the other hand, when we slow down to consider God and who he's revealed himself to be, we begin to see a clearer picture of ourselves. In fact, we must look to God if we are to ever get a true reflection of ourselves. So in the Institutes, Calvin, he says, it's evident that man never attains to a true self-knowledge until he has previously contemplated the face of God and come down after such contemplation to look into himself. Man is never sufficiently touched and affected by the awareness of his lowly state until he has compared himself with God's majesty. So as we kind of plumb the depths of ourselves and plumb the depths of who God has shown us he is, one thing becomes apparent to us: our God is entirely beyond us in every single way. Like, we don't worship a God who's merely a greater version of ourselves. He is other. He's other. And he's entirely perfect. Nothing and no one greater could even be conceived by us. Like, we will spend all eternity exploring and getting to know who God is and still never get to the bottom of his greatness. And as for us, like, when we start down that road, we go, who are we? Like, who are we? In light of God's glory, we see how lowly we are. We see how sinful we are. We see how much we truly need Jesus. And here's what I want to say. As we grow in our knowledge of God and of ourselves, it becomes just unthinkable that we could somehow clean ourselves up with our own measly effort, right? Like, it becomes almost laughable. Like, we want to be a people whose lives are changed, but that can't happen through just our willpower or resolutions, or techniques, or whatever it is that we think we need. We have to be formed by Jesus. We need to be formed by Jesus. And this transformation comes from our worship, right? As we behold and we treasure the glory of Jesus, we're changed more and more into his image, right? 2 Corinthians, and we all with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. As we behold him, as we see him, as we see his glory, we are transformed. And so as we take time to study God's attributes, we really hope that God shapes our vision, that we could behold him. And as we come to see God more clearly, everything around us changes, and we ourselves change. I mean, think for a moment just about like our need right now for resilience, right? We need, our people need resilience to stand firm in the midst of cultural opposition or faith-shaking suffering. And we can come in and tell people what to do till we're blue in the face. We could say, hey, you need to remain steadfast, keep the faith. Jesus is enough. All those things are good and right and true to say, but what's truly going to empower us to endure is when we catch a vision of God. When we actually behold him. When we see him as he is in and through all of those things that we're feeling. When we remember God's power and his goodness. When we remember his otherness, that he isn't like us. He isn't affected like us. He isn't in this world like us. He's different. He is other. When we recall his power and his mercy, when we behold God, that's when we can lift our heads, when we can strengthen our weak knees, when we can move forward with hope in God. And so as we kind of enter this cultural season where people are just naturally longing for change in their lives, we kind of stand there to lift up the glory of God and say, behold him. Behold your God and be made new. Like, that's what you need more than anything else. All those other things are great, but this is what we need to behold the glory of God. And so, Lord, we don't want to stay where we are. We're not satisfied with the sin and the places that we find ourselves. God, in fact, we're sick of our sin and we're sick of our waywardness and the ways that we justify it. And God, would you just renew us? Would you transform us into your image? Would you make us more and more like you? So Jesus, would you come and work in us? And would you give us a bigger vision of you that prompts us to follow you, not so much out of duty, though we need to do that, but out of just seeing the beauty of who you are. Yeah. Work that in us and work that in our people, Jesus. Okay, so the last prayer I want to keep before us is, Lord, bless us with your presence. Lord, bless us with your presence. And for this, I'm specifically thinking about the people in this room. Like those of us who are in ministry, those of us who are laboring. And here's what I want to remind us. Ministry can never become the thing that we just do. Like, we're not interested in doing work for God that's somehow separated from God. Like, above all, those of us who work in the church need to continually behold and see God for who he is, right? Colossians 3, if you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Like for us in all of our work and all of our looking outward and caring for people and wondering how God's going to work in the city, we have to keep our eyes up focused on Jesus, beholding God, seeing him in all of his glory. And this is what drives our mission. This is what drives our service. This is what drives our care. Like, ministry is not some objective good that tips the scales in our favor to earn some brownie points with God or something like that. Like, in case you've forgotten, let me just remind you, God doesn't need you. God doesn't need you. He doesn't need your ministry. He doesn't need our church. He is doing just fine, and he will advance his mission in this city with or without us. Like, he's not begging us to do some work for him. Instead, ministry is a blessing that God invites us into. It's an invitation for us to get a front row seat to see what God is doing. Like, we get to go to work with our Father. And we might bellyache about it and complain about it, but here's the truth. It is one of the greatest callings and blessings in all of creation that we get to do. I mean, again, right after what I just read in 2 Corinthians, Paul says, therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart. If you're called to labor in the church to ministry, it is God's mercy towards you. Okay. If you are called to ministry, to work in the church, it is God's mercy towards you. It's his grace towards you. It is a gift he has given you. This is how God's chosen to grow you and sanctify you, increase your faith, increase your joy in him. And so here, all that to say, to try to do this without him, to sacrifice our faith even on the altar of ministry, would be hell on earth. Like, that would be the eternal winter without Christmas. Like, we get to do this with God, and we can never forget that. This doesn't replace our discipleship. This doesn't replace our faith. This is the journey God has set us on. After Israel created the golden calf in the wilderness, God's judgment burned towards his people, and he speaks these just like terrifying words to Moses, where he says, "Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people." And we have to ask ourselves, like, God is offering Moses a land flowing with milk and honey. Like, if God offered us a ministry flowing with milk and honey, but without him, would we go? Like, if he gave us everything we could want, but he wasn't there with us, would we go? And listen to Moses, hear the desperation in his voice in the midst of all of this. He says, "But now, if you will forgive their sin, but if not, please blot me out of the book that you have written." It would be better for me to die, is what he's saying. It'd be better for me to die. "If your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here." Listen, if God is not with us, what are we even doing here? Like, what are we doing? And that's why, like, I think for us, there's something to receive as we're beholding God, is remembering we need to behold God. And we need his presence. We want more of God. We need more of him. We need to see him more clearly, because this isn't just something we're out there doing for him. It's something we're doing with him. Something we're doing with him. And so, Lord, we don't want to go on without you. We do not want to do ministry without you. Ministry is pointless without you, without your presence. So God, we long for your presence. And God, would you help us? Would you help us to actually eat the meal that we're offering to others? God, as we look at the attributes of God, as we look at your attributes and your character and your beauty, would we feast on you? Would we remember you? Would our vision of you be captured and renewed? Jesus, we need you. And God, please, God, keep us from doing anything where we're trying to do ministry without you. Where we're trying to just figure out in our own power, in our own strength, how to change people, how to reach people, how to preach things, how to do stuff. But our hearts are just far from you. God, keep us from that. Save us from that. More than ministry success, we want your presence. We want your presence. So God, would you please just bless us with your presence? Yeah. Amen.